This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
You know, it's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it.
People are wondering who's going to be next.
The Genesis has begun. It's a new beginning, the beginning of the New World Order.
And on one given night, as you two amigos destroy the top talent in the WCW.
The preceding announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
When discussing pop culture in the mid to late 90s, it would be really difficult to have a thorough discussion about that time period and not arrive at the NWO in some form or fashion, and by de facto, professional wrestling. It was in 1996 that Hulk Hogan executed his long-awaited big heel turn, which ended up giving the character of Hulk Hogan significant life to what was a very failing babyface run in WCW. Fast forward, and now we look back nearly 30 years since the NWO was formed in 1996, and Mark Raimondi, former MMA reporter, now an NFL beat writer for the Atlanta Falcons, has just put out Say Hello to the Bad Guys, How Professional Wrestling's New World Order Changed America. In this discussion with Mark, we talk about the influence the NWO had in terms of taking WCW and becoming the number one wrestling promotion worldwide, and also its fall from grace as creative and behind-the-scenes influence affected the product on screen. Plus, we talk about the entire process of putting together a project of this magnitude and conducting all of the interviews that he set out to do, and also talking about the NWO, a topic that has been covered in so many different facets around professional wrestling and the industry at large. So here is my chat with Mark Raimondi.
What's up, John? Why is Wade ducking me? Where is he? Where is Wade Ting, my guy?
I demanded that he show up for this, and he had the audacity to use the "I just had my second child" as an excuse. I mean, come on, Wade. I mean,
you didn't have the stroke, John, to get him here despite the birth.
In this equation, you are definitely Tom Aspinall. I don't want to directly equate Wei Ting to John Jones. Probably not the week to be doing that. But yes, Wei Ting does send his regards. And I know that he will be devouring this book as he is on a baby duty on overnights at the moment.
All right. Fair enough. Well, I wish him the best. And even though he's ducking me, we still love you, Wei.
So I want to go back to UFC 297. And there you and I were there at the media day. And I distinctly remember like a 5,000-pound weight off your shoulders because you informed me that you had just turned in your book and what a process this was. So this was January of 2024. Mm-hmm. And tell me a bit about just that period of, like, I'm sure everyone has the idea of the amount of work that goes into a book, but it's not until you do it. It's kind of like climbing Mount Everest, isn't it, Mark? You don't really know what you're getting into until you've completed the task.
That's true. That's true, right? Now that you say that, you know, we were having Tim Hortons, right, in Toronto.
That's right.
And it was mid-January, and I sent in the manuscript on December 29th, 2023. So it was like 2 weeks later, basically. And it was 110,000 words, the manuscript that I first sent in. It's been edited down since then. The book is not that long, but a long process, man. And, it was a process that I think a lot of people who have written books would kind of understand what I'm about to say. It's kind of like a love-hate relationship because I love wrestling. I love to write. I love reporting. This is my passion. This is what I do, right? You know, this is what I live for. This is what I wake up for in the morning. But when you have a book and also a full-time job that needs you to travel 1 to 2 weeks out of the month, it can get a little bit overwhelming, and I was definitely in that place a lot. And just also, I think the hardest part of the book is just like, I know this is going to sound kind of a silly thing to say, but it's so long, you know, there's so much of it. And you start to kind of like doubt yourself a little bit, like through the process, like, is this even making any sense? Like, is anyone even going to understand what I'm talking about? You know what I mean? Like, is this any good? Is this crap? You know, and so many times I went back and I'm like, this sucks. You know, I'm gonna start this chapter over again. And, you know, but, you know, just a really rewarding process in the end. but certainly one that, you know, I have had, you know, some mental health things to overcome over the last 4 years since I've been working on it.
What were kind of the reactions in the moment when you first got like a copy of the book in your hands, the finished product? And also at that point where it's like, I can't do any more work. Like it's done, it's ready to go out. Like, was there a feeling of completion, of that this was a success, or probably also mixed with, man, how is this going to be received? And all these other questions that I'm sure go through your mind.
Yeah, I mean, this is horrible to say, but I feel like I don't even know if it's set in yet, because I've been so busy on this book tour. You know, I've done so many interviews, and I just got back from Los Angeles at about 2 a.m. this morning. I feel like the work is still being done for it. But this part is like almost harder than writing the book, because yeah. I'm not used to promoting myself. Like, I am usually the person where you are, John. You know, I'm usually the person doing the interview, as you know. And it is really weird, like, trying to sell something and trying to promote something that I did. And I mean, to an extent, I like it because I do believe in the book and I'm passionate about it. And I think that we have something really cool and fun for, you know, and beyond for fans. But I would almost rather write like another book than have to do another like book tour, like another like I'm an introvert. You know, I'm not like it drains my like social battery to be doing all this stuff. Luckily, caffeine, you know, is helpful. But it's been a lot. And I don't know if like. I hope that sometime in the next few days I can actually sit down and like have like a moment, maybe just me and my wife, and kind of enjoy it. But that moment has not happened yet. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. I know this is all part of the process.
Yeah, no, I think I'd be very similar. Like, obviously I've never written a book. It would be a really daunting process, but just like following your social media and just like that, to me, I always believed it was kind of a, like, you know, 70-30 divide of the actual work of the book, and then there's the promoting of the book. Mm-hmm. I think those percentages are probably a lot closer, that it's like that's stage one. You get the book done and then it's getting it out there. And that's a whole process in and of itself of creative ways to get this to an audience. And like that aspect of things is, you know, it can be very difficult, especially from your role as like reporter. And now you are the subject here.
I feel like I'm getting like my marketing degree right now in book promotion, because I didn't really know what to expect, honestly. And I didn't even know like how much was like I was gonna have to do. And I don't want to say like have to do, like, oh my God, this is terrible. It's not, you know, it's that would be overstating it. But, it is like, it's so hard to fight through all of the content, right? And like, just let, cause like, look, my feeling has always been since day one of working on this book that there is absolutely a giant audience that wants to read this book. It's just a matter of trying to, you know, get in touch with them and tell them that it exists. I've had so many people, even just in the last like couple of days, say, I didn't even know this book existed. You know, and I've been trying to promote it for like almost, you know, for months now, even going back to last year when it was first available for pre-order, but still people don't know about it even now probably. And that's just a crazy thing. And it's like, how do you, it's almost like wrestling, right? Like, how do you get over? Like, how do you do something that's compelling that people want to continue to consume? And that's really what, you know, this book promotion is just trying to like let as many people know that it exists, because I think that people want to buy it if they knew that it was there, you know, that they knew that it was available to them on Amazon or wherever.
We're kind of going backwards here of like kind of the end process, but at the start, like you've talked about how kind of this kind of in some ways came into your lap, or you were offered this opportunity mm-hmm. to write a book coming out of a feature you did on ESPN.com. When you go through the proposal and it's greenlit and now it's time to just sit down and start this, like it is just this gigantic, you know, concept that you now have to tackle. Where are you starting? Like, is it just lining up who are the must-haves that you want to yep. speak with? How are you tackling this on like day one of like the reporting process?
The first thing that I thought I needed to do was get in touch with Eric Bischoff. That was like my first, like, all right, let me see if I can talk to Bischoff. And before I had even like agreed to doing the book, before I even did the proposal, I was like, I need to talk to Bischoff to make sure that he will grant me an interview, because I don't even know if I can do this book without sitting down with Eric Bischoff for an extended period of time. So I met with him the weekend of Double or Nothing 2021 in Jacksonville, Florida, at a Dave and Buster's. I explained to him what I was doing, you know, who I was, and that I, you know, really needed his help. And he said, whatever you need, basically. And it was a pretty easy, quick conversation. And he completely followed through with that. I was able to go to his home in Cody, Wyoming about 2 years ago now and sit down with him for many, many hours. I met his wife, you know, we were at his home, and he was, so welcoming and so cordial, you know, and really, I mean, time is everything, right? And he was so, you know, generous with his time, and I'm very grateful for that. So that was a big deal. And then, you know, once I kind of got, you know, my ducks in a row as far as who I wanted to interview, which was like a ton of people, then I started to do, the first thing that I really did was the research, which was I started watching what ended up being over 500 hours of WCW programming from 96, you know, mid 96 to like mid 99, basically. So it was like an hour and a half in the morning, an hour and a half at night, almost every day for like over a year. I forget exactly how long it took me, because I wanted to, before I actually went and did the bulk of the interviews, John, I wanted to have a really good working knowledge of the product. So I took like copious notes of every Nitro episode, every Thunder episode, every pay-per-view, because I wanted to have that very quickly available to me, because I'm asking people questions from about things that happened 30 years ago. You know, they're not going to remember exact details and time and place, and I need to have like a really good working knowledge of, you know, where, what that was and what, you know, where that was. So that was important. And then once I finished watching toward the tail end, that's when I started to reach out for interviews. And I did the majority of my interviews in 2023, like the first half of 2023. And I interviewed almost 100 people, a lot of backstage folks in WCW, you know, ton of wrestlers, of course. And then, you know, for, you know, kind of the subtitle, right, is How It Changed America. So I interviewed, you know, college professors, sociologists, pop culture experts, authors, people like that. Andrew Yang, the former presidential candidate in the United States, I interviewed him as well for the book. And, you know, some folks like that, some Hollywood producers who could speak to the impact in Hollywood, people in music and what have you. So, approach it like in a dual way, like here's the history, but here's also the influence, you know, and I wanted to kind of live together in the same book.
How do you look at someone like a Hulk Hogan from your perspective of, here is a major name, I'm sure, obviously, for a project like this, of course, you're going to jump at the chance if a Hogan wants to speak with you. But I mean, with Hogan, it's like you kind of know what you're going to get. It's, you know, it's Hogan memory that sometimes does not exactly jive with facts and such. Mm-hmm. And you found so many of these interesting characters, like me personally, and maybe this is not going to be like the name that's going to sell your book, but I'm way more interested in hearing from like Peter Young, who was Hogan's agent, than Hulk Hogan himself. And you, like, you're the Neil Pruitts of the world, Mike Webbers, like these kinds of people that you track down that have all of this knowledge that have probably never spoken too in depth about this, where it's been a very limited amount over all of these years, that were right there and typically are some of the most interesting voices to hear from.
Yeah, and I think that you'd probably agree with me, John, that what you just said, like, sometimes it's not the folks that are the big names that everyone, you know, you put on a marquee and people recognize it. Sometimes it's the people that were there that had this intimate knowledge of what was happening and are not household names. And I would say the biggest one of those for me was Ellis Edwards, who was the stunt coordinator for WCW for, you know, the whole mid-90s. And then he was that same guy for Vince McMahon for many years in WWF. And he's done very few interviews. Maybe not. I don't even know if he's done any interviews really over the years. So I think probably a couple. But he was also very gracious with his time. I sat down with him in Atlanta in person when I came out here for book research. And, you know, the way that he was able to explain in great detail just how they did Sting rappelling down from the rafters every single Monday night for like, you know, years was pretty incredible. You know, the way that he was able to break it down and explain to me, like in really technical terms, how they would do it. And just some of the stories about, you know, Sting being up there and even also some of the stories about like when the Steiner's car, you know, their car crashed, the NWO was tailgating them and, you know, led to the car flipping over. Ellis Edwards was the stunt driver, you know, for that in the car at that point. And just, you know, his recollection of that stuff was really, really cool. And then the big names are, you know, for the most part, the big names have said their piece about this era, right? You know, we kind of know what, you know, Hogan, Hall, and Nash about to say about it because they've spoken for so many years about it. So, you know, I did not interview Hulk Hogan for the book. I was able to interview, like you said, people that around him, like Peter Young, his agent, Henry Holmes, his lawyer, Jimmy Hart, of course, people like that. And I was able to obtain some interviews with Hulk Hogan that have never really been like released wide. Same thing with Kevin Nash interviews. I did speak to Kevin Nash on the phone. It wasn't the kind of interview that I would have loved. You know, I would have, you know, would have wanted to go down to Daytona and chat with him in person where he lives, but it didn't work out. It's been a tough time in his life, right, over the last couple of years. So sure. Understood. But yeah, I mean, as far as that goes, it really is like those periphery people. Even someone like a Dwight Manley, Dennis Rodman's agent, was so, you know, incredible to talk to because I don't think he's been asked about wrestling for 30 years. So it's cool to kind of get his memory and perspective of what happened in like 97 and 98 with Rodman and WCW.
When you're getting all these different perspectives, and here is like the interest of a major publisher to do a book on the NWO that, you know, we're coming up on 30 years since this launched. Like, what is it about that period that is so romanticized? And is it that a lot of, you know, people that have like grew up in that period are now in these positions where they look back like that was wrestling to them? Like, this is still something that to many people is like their golden age of pro wrestling, and the NWO kind of typifies that.
100%. Well, yeah, I mean, that was really where it was born, because the editor from Simon & Schuster that I contacted me, his name is Yadon Israel, and he is a little bit younger than me, but he grew up in the NWO era. And he actually told me a great story about how he changed schools when he was a kid. And at his new school, like the first thing that the kids asked him, like in middle school, was, are you NWO or are you WCW? And he was not allowed to watch wrestling at that time. His parents didn't let him. This was in Brooklyn, New York. And he didn't know what to say. And they kind of like beat him up, but not really beat him up, like a worked beat down, like a wrestling beat down, like just kind of like tapping him on the back. And that's when he realized, like, what this was. And he started to go to his friend's place on Monday nights without his parents knowing to watch WCW, because they didn't want him watching wrestling. So he just said, I'm going to go study, or I'm going to go do whatever. And they would really be watching wrestling every Monday night. And, you know, that was inspirational to him. And now he's an editor at a major publishing house. And that's kind of what the book is about, John. It's like, all of us who lived through that time as, you know, kids, teens, young adults are now, you know, grown up, and we're in the world and in the workforce. And, you know, whatever it is we're doing, we still kind of carry that with us, like that child inside that watched, you know, the Attitude Era, that watched the NWO. And I think the NWO resonates so much because it was the catalyst to all of that stuff that happened in 90s wrestling, right? It was, you know, things were bad for both companies. The NWO happens, and it is the chain reaction to so many different things that have happened over the years. And it was really also when wrestling became cool, where it wasn't really cool before then. If you're in school, right, you're not really advertising that you're a wrestling fan in 1993. But in 96 and 97, you actually had to know what was going on in wrestling in school, because it was the cool thing. It was what people were talking about. You need to be kind of, you know, part of the in crowd. And I think that's what people remember, that it was like just a formative part of their childhood. And I think that's why wrestling is so special, because there is that nostalgia factor that few things have. And you almost associate yourself and your own childhood with what was happening in wrestling. You can have a conversation with any, like, you know, or many, many men, especially like around my age, in the US or Canada, and you can kind of almost have like a you know, kind of like a throwback conversation about what wrestling you watched as kids.
Support for this Post Wrestling Podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
You also, like, it's more than just, you know, focusing on, like, the pro wrestling industry. It's also an industry that's in flux of society and the world around it. And I really liked how you zoned in on like the rap and hip hop influence that the NWO was very much connected with, from, you know, Hall and Nash coming out to Lauryn Hill with Conan and such. And it's kind of detailed in the book, like when Hall, Nash and Hogan first come together, it's like Nash and Hall have like a very, you know, focused idea of what this needs to be. And Hulk Hogan is not cool at this point, to the outside or internally. And it's like this really weird evolution that ends up being something that greatly adds on legs to the Hulk Hogan character from the mid 90s, where, you know, he was sputtering in that babyface role, but it took, I think, like Hall and Nash, they were kind of these special ingredients that were kind of linking WCW to a much cooler brand.
Yeah, that you're right on. And the funny thing about like Hogan is that in 85, he was cool. You know, in 88 and 87, he was cool. He was cool for the 80s and maybe the very early 90s, but culture shifts. And that's the thing about wrestling too, is that you have to kind of, you know, ride with what's going on in the real world. You have to kind of like be a parallel to the real world to really capture, you know, what they want. And Hulk Hogan by 96 was not cool. Like you said, that was the red and yellow, the, you know, say your vitamins, say your prayers, eat your vitamins. That was just not a cool thing. It was, you know, the 90s was like, you know, hip hop, it was rap, it was Nirvana, it was grunge, it was, you know, all these different things. And it certainly was not like bright colors and, you know, Hulkamania, brother. It was not that at all. So Hulk Hogan comes in and, you know, he knows this is going to be a big deal. So he, of course, wants to insert himself into this. But him and Hall and Nash are on a completely different wavelength as far as how they wanted to present this group. And Hall and Nash had this idea of, you know, the cool, the urban, you know, like gang culture, hip hop culture. You know, we're going to throw up a baseball bat, beat people down, you know, backstage, the wearing black, you know, the bandanas tied like Tupac in the front, that type of thing. And it took Hogan a little bit to kind of get up to speed as to what that would look like. And some of that involved like actually actively taking things from Hall and Nash that made them unique, like the 5 o'clock shadow that, you know, that Razor Ramon and Scott Hall had for many years. Hulk Hogan developed that as well, right? That was not something that he did when he was the red and yellow. And, you know, just trying to get up to speed about what people wanted. And I think he deserves credit because he was able to, I mean, look, his babyface run is legendary, right? He was the biggest name ever in wrestling as a babyface from 85 to the mid 90s. And then to be one of the leaders, if not the leader of that 90s pro wrestling boom as the NWO, you know, frontman, as Hollywood Hogan, another legendary run, right? As a heel. Very few wrestlers, actually, I would say no wrestler ever has had a babyface run like that. Right before a heel run like that. So he definitely deserves credit. But and Bischoff, what you mentioned about kind of like the contrast between Hall and Nash and Hogan, Bischoff, the way Bischoff puts it in the book is that like Hulk Hogan was this, you know, Marvel Star Wars like creation of the 80s and Vince McMahon. He was manufactured, he was built up, Hulkamania. And Hall and Nash were when wrestling was like street level, urban, you know, edgy, gritty, and organic. And Hulk Hogan was almost not organic. He was a creation. And they put those two things together, and it could have been oil and water. And maybe in the beginning, a little bit it was, but eventually it became this like magical combination that has not been duplicated really ever since then.
You got to spend time with Eric Bischoff. And I think, you know, when you look at Eric Bischoff's legacy in pro wrestling, like these several years are going to be front and center of his most significant contributions. Where do you see sort of his own securities about, you know, the history of this? Like so much of it, I feel like Eric Bischoff is someone like he owns up in this book to like, yeah, missteps here, other mistakes. It's not like this is a guy that just looks like everything I did was flawless. But I think you do get some of that just Eric Bischoff as a whole that pushes back against kind of the reporting on the fall of WCW and what his contributions were. How do you feel Eric Bischoff is securing his own kind of contributions in this whole period for WCW? Because what he did is of great significance that they got WCW to this level for the several year period, but it was followed by a big descent.
I really think so. Here's the way that I look at Eric Bischoff, and I think that, you know, the NWO is his brainchild, but it's also, we talk about Hall and Nash and Hogan, but I think that the vibe of WCW and the NWO was very much Eric Bischoff. And he was an outsider as well. And that's what people kind of forget about him. He's not a guy that grew up in the wrestling business. He kind of fell into it by accident, right? His first job in the AWA on camera was because someone got busted for DUI and got arrested and he had to fill in for him. And then he didn't get the job, as first executive, producer of WCW, until, Bill Watts got in trouble, right, for making, you know, racist remarks. And, so he kind of like fell into all this stuff, and it's like, he's not, you know, he's not a guy that people think is a wrestling mind. He's not part of like the old boys club. He's very much an outsider. And what he brought to Nitro was this outsider's perspective. He brought, and this is pre-NWO I'm talking about, he mm-hmm. brought like this brashness, you know, a little bit younger, a little bit more, you know, irreverent, that was not at that time part of what WCW was, certainly as a kind of more a Southern-based wrestling promotion. And what I'm talking about is like giving away the results of Raw when Raw was taped and Nitro was live. Like, that's pre-NWO. That's just Bischoff trying to, you know, needle WWF and get a reaction out of them and build buzz. You know, Lex Luger showing up on the first Nitro as a huge surprise days after his contract unknowingly expires in WWF. You know, Medusa coming in from the WWF and throwing the women's title from the WWF in the trash. These are all Bischoff brainchilds, right? Brain children, I guess you could say. And they predate the NWO. And Nitro, even before the NWO, was actually successful in the ratings against Raw because of some of these things that he was doing. And it was pissing off the WWF a great deal, because what he was doing was not, you know, it was not considered traditional wrestling. It was not something that you did. You didn't throw someone's championship in the garbage. So he brought that kind of like, you know, attitude, you know, before the Attitude Era, he brought that kind of attitude, his own attitude, to the product. And the NWO was kind of a spawn of that, right? It's kind of a spawn of, you know, Bischoff's own personality and his own attitude. And it was very much like, you know, so Vince McMahon counters all that stuff that Bischoff was doing with the billionaire Ted skits, mm-hmm. right? And the NWO was almost a counter in many ways to the billionaire Ted skits. Cause what does Scott Hall say in that first promo? He references billionaire Ted. He references the Nacho Man, the huckster, right? So it was almost like his way of like going back at the WWF. And then of course there was a lawsuit and all that, but he really put a ton. I mean, he became wholly obsessed with beating Vince McMahon and beating the WWF, maybe even putting them out of business. Like, that was like, this man woke up every day with like a fire in his eyes in 96 and 97 with the idea that I'm going to kill the WWF and I'm going to, you know, reign supreme. And they were so wildly successful for so long, because of the NWO. And I would argue also about how, and I told Eric this, because from, you know, from talking to so many people involved in WCW, one of his greatest, you know, aside from, you know, just the idea of the NWO, I think one of his greatest skills or things he was able to do for at least a period of time was just keeping things together. Because even in late 96, things were starting to boil over between Hogan and Nash, and the idea of like, who does the NWO really belong to? Who takes ownership over the success of the group? That was already kind of bubbling up even before a year was out, right? 96. And then it really got bad like in 98. And that's when Bischoff kind of like, he really threw in with Hogan. Like, he was trying to manage it the best he could for so long. And in 98 is really when he threw in with Hogan, and he just kind of like, he just kept betting on Hogan. You know, they fired Sean Waltman, which was kind of like a political statement against Hall and Nash. And he made sure that, you know, that Hogan, you know, he felt like where the business was going, where Hogan was going, right? And that was almost, you know, eventually to his detriment. You understand why he would do that, because Hogan was the proven guy. But things do change and things do evolve. And I think that by, you know, mid and even late 98, that fire and that passion that, you know, I want to win and I want to beat Vince and I want to beat the WWF, I think it he was getting burnt out. You know, it wasn't there the way it was in 96 and 97. And there are reasons why. And one of them is just, you know, the infighting politically backstage, the merger going on where he's, you know, he has to do all these meetings with, you know, folks from Turner and AOL and Time Warner, the lawsuit that was continuing to drag on for years between the WWF and WCW. And by like late 98, early 99, His creative juices ran out. You know, they were dry, and he really didn't have anything. And he has admitted this. It's like, I was just green lighting things. People came to me and I said, sure, you know, and they went with it. He was not kind of mustering any creative ideas himself. And I think that's what it is. It's like, he was a supernova, you know, for a period of time that burnt out because he put everything that he had and he could into that time period and was successful. But then it all kind of came crashing down. You know, it's like almost like, you know, when your body just crashes after, like, you know, being on adrenaline for so long. That's kind of what happened to Eric Bischoff.
Yeah, like 1998 is such a fascinating year because you can look at it on paper that here is their most profitable year, mm-hmm. but you're kicking it off with Nitro moving to 3 hours. You introduce Thunder in mm-hmm. in lockstep with that as well. You're producing more television than ever. But you know, you went and rewatched it, Mark. Like, you just see the on-screen product of where it's going, but it kind of gets camouflaged when Goldberg comes out of nowhere and just becomes mm-hmm. this phenom. And as late as, like, there's a period in late 98 in, like, December into the January 4th show at the Georgia Dome. They do 3 stadium shows within, mm-hmm. like, 4 or 5 weeks.
Yep.
And they're drawing, like, 30 to 40,000 people for these shows, for Nitros. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this company is still red hot going into 99. But you're seeing that, like, the creative is sputtering. And then into 1999, you see the legs kind of fall out underneath it. And I know you talk about it a lot in the book, like the finger poke of doom. It's one where, like, that is kind of this demarcation point for the company. And it was a real slap in the face to that audience. And you saw it when they would come back to Atlanta later that year and you had a lot less people coming mm-hmm. back.
Yeah, no, certainly. And one thing that I've always learned from Dave Meltzer over the years and his great work at the Wrestling Observer is that the business tends to lag behind the creative in the sense that, you know, you build up the creative and you start doing well. And then in 98, you saw the creative kind of fell off a cliff a little bit, especially by the middle to the end of the year. And the business is still good, but the creative is not good. So it takes a while for the business to catch up to the creative as far as that goes. And the same thing on the other side, the creative can be really good when you're building it up and the business is not there yet. So it takes a little bit to kind of establish that credibility with the audience. But Starrcade 97 was kind of the first, like, chink in the armor where you could see that credibility with the audience start to dissipate because that was just a debacle. We don't need to even go into that. You know, for wrestling fans, they know how bad that was. But what people forget, John, I think, is that the Nitro after Starrcade 97 was an absolute mess. It was the rematch between Hogan and Sting, and the show goes off the air before the finish of the match. And they don't show the finish again until a week and a half later on the premiere of Thunder as a ratings ploy. And it's like, and even then with that, there was no definitive conclusion that the title went vacant. So it was like, Starrcade 97 was bad, but you could have patched it up the next day. You could have made it right and moved on and still had a sustained, coherent, creative direction. Instead, it became even more muddled and terrible because you're pretty much giving, like, the middle finger to your audience that has been investing in this Sting character and this storyline for over a year, because now you're going off the air and you're not showing it until, you know, as a draw to get people to watch the new show. That was so kind of crummy of them. You know, that was really kind of, like, cheap of them and unnecessary because they were so successful. They didn't need to do that. You know, they didn't need to, you know, try to leverage viewers to watch Nitro by, you know, hurting them in the beginning by not showing it on, you know, I'm sorry, to watch Thunder instead of showing it on Nitro as it should have been. It was so disappointing to see because that was that could have been the big celebration of WCW, Starrcade 97 and beyond, and you know, Sting wins, and maybe that's the end of the NWO, or at least that part of the story arc. And it just didn't happen that way. It was just so muddled. And then, you know, fast forward a year later, and you're right, and that's something that Dave Meltzer also always says, is that if not for Goldberg getting hot in 98, things might have tailed off for WCW a lot earlier honestly, because the NWO creative and that stuff was not great in the beginning of 98 either. And then the Rodman and Malone stuff kind of saved them, right? That did big numbers. The Jay Leno stuff also did decent numbers. That kind of saved them in the summer. But then by the fall, it was like Hogan was bringing Warrior back in, you know, to feud with the Warrior. And that was a complete disaster. And then the Finger Poke of Doom comes in January 99. And there's the photo there. And it was just like, this is just now got kind of a phony wrestling angle. You know, the aura of the NWO, like kids like to say aura, the aura of the NWO was dead after the Finger Poke of Doom. It didn't exist anymore. It just kind of became like this, you know, this phony wrestling angle again, instead of like a revolutionary storyline.
So as we wrap up on the wrestling portion here, you have like the unique perspective that you have done this extensive reporting on WCW during this time period. And you were also very much covering like AEW on its ascent. Mm-hmm. Did you draw any parallels of WCW in periods to kind of modern day AEW and sort of just the similarities, differences to, you know, the first competitor WWE has really had in the domestic market in two decades?
The big parallel is the competition and how that can breed success and breed, you know, better quality of programming, because again, WWF in 1996 was not good. It was not in 95, 96. It was not a good product. I mean, the NWO, people forget like that the NWO debuted obviously like in May, June, July, 96. At that time, like, T.L. Hopper was in WWF, like the wrestling plumber, like the goon, the wrestling hockey player. The Body Donnas were on Raw. It's like you're on, you know, you flip to Nitro and it's like Hall and Nash beating up dudes backstage with baseball bats, you know? And then you turn to the WWF and it's Henry and Phineas Godwin like pouring slop on people. And it's like it's not even the same genre almost anymore, right? Nitro went so much, you know, grittier and more adult, and the WWF was still stuck in like the early 90s. They were not evolving. And you know, you have to wonder what, you know, what would happen, you know, what would have happened if there was no NWO to push Vince McMahon to change things up and put a better product out there for the fans. And I think that's where WWE was before AEW. They were in a place where they were not being pushed. They were not motivated, you know, necessarily, because they were making their money. They were profitable, right? But they were not pushing to put on the best possible product every single week and month for their audience, because there was no competition. They were just kind of cruising along, right? Doing their thing, making money, whatever. And now AEW comes along in 2019 and, you know, does real well out of the gate. They're on national TV. Their pay-per-view numbers are pretty good. You know, the ratings are pretty strong. At one point, they're even, you know, kind of like pushing Raw, the demographic, a little bit. And, you know, they're beating NXT pretty handily every week on Wednesdays. And that forces, again, the WWE to change. And I think that the Bloodline storyline and Roman Reigns as the heel, you know, protagonist of WWE is born out of that competition in a way. And now WWE is red hot, and they have been for a couple of years. And I don't know if that would be the case if not for AEW pushing them in that direction. And I say red hot business wise, but, you know, also red hot, I think, creatively. I think the Bloodline was incredible, you know, incredible storytelling that you just weren't seeing in WWE for two decades until AEW showed up.
I do want to ask a couple MMA-related questions to you. First of all,
what does that stand for?
Well, I find it interesting that at UFC 297, little did we know you were on your own, John Cena farewell tour at that point, listing the amount of events that you had left. You know, you have since moved on. You are now covering the Atlanta Falcons full time. How would you describe your relationship with MMA at this point? Are you still like checking in? Are you following it at your leisure, or have you detoxed off MMA after being as heavily involved covering it as anyone?
I truly have not watched many fights in the last year since I left. I really haven't. There's been a few that I've really wanted to sit down and watch, but for the most part, man, I have not watched many. And part of it is like living on the East Coast now. I'm in Atlanta. Man, that stuff starts late.
Oh, it's tough over here.
I mean, I don't know how you guys do it, because I lived in LA, right? And when I wasn't on the road, it wasn't too difficult to watch on a Saturday night because of the time, you know, the time zone. But in the East Coast, it's like 10 o'clock main card. I'm asleep I'm asleep by, 11:30, 12. I'm not watching that main event, on pay-per-view. But yeah, I mean, look, it was like a big part of my life, right, for over a decade. And I made some of my best friends in that world. You included, John. Yeah, I would throw you in there as a friend, obviously, that I met in MMA. I met my wife through MMA, because she was a reporter and she was a fighter. So it's like I still obviously have fond thoughts and memories about the sport, but I just have not been as dialed in. Now, I still know everything that's going on because it's still all over my social media. I haven't like unfollowed anyone. So it's still like probably the primary thing that I see on social media over everything. But I'm just not like I'm like a dirty casual now when it comes to MMA. Isn't that weird?
Well, what was the impetus for you to make the change when you did? Like, were you sensing just, was it just a burnout on MMA itself? Was it like a combination of a new opportunity to cover something different? Because like, it's not like you had a laneway in MMA covering like real important stories. And it's not like there's a line around the corner of reporters that are jumping on those stories anymore. And I think that's to the sport's detriment, that there's a lot of big stories out there, but it's kind of finding the audience to, tell these important stories.
And that's just it. I feel like the audience had changed a lot, since COVID. I felt like it was a new audience, and I almost felt like deja vu, as like I needed to start doing the same stories that I used to do like 10 years earlier for this new audience. And I was like, do I want, like, I got to write about like the scoring criteria again and like, referees. And I need to kind of write about the stuff that I was doing in like 2015, 2014, because the audience does not, it's a whole new audience. It's a whole new group of people that don't understand kind of like the basic foundation of MMA. Like they started watching, they enjoyed it, but they didn't really know how it really worked behind the scenes. And I was like, man, it's tough to kind of go back and do the same stuff over again that I've already done, that I already did. And I feel like the audience was changing. Things were, skewing younger, skewing more to like the video and the YouTube audience, like, streamers, influencers type of deal. And I felt like, part of me felt like kind of a dinosaur, where I'm mostly a writer, right? I certainly did some, a good amount of video stuff for ESPN as well, covering MMA. But, I think of myself as a writer, and that's what I want to do. I want to report. I want to write. And I just felt like at this moment in time that, maybe I had aged out of MMA as far as like what the fans wanted. And I think that, knowing, and I think you probably agree with this, Sean, like knowing the audience, who are you targeting? Like, who are you, like, what, who is this for? And I always think about that when I'm writing, or when I'm, even doing stuff like this, like, who is this for? And I was having a hard time kind of like, matching that up in my head with MMA. And, there's other reasons too. I mean, the NFL thing came along and it was really, really hard to pass up the biggest sport in America, if that's out there, and also I just think like, I'll always be a fight fan, and I'll always consider myself like a fight reporter, and maybe I will be again one day. But I also really believe that, we only get one life. We only get one career. I'm 40 years old now, and it's cool to do different things, like try, take on new challenges, like, get out of your comfort zone. And I really did that because I left the sport that I covered for over a decade for a sport that I hadn't covered in almost 20 years, actually. I moved across the country from, LA to Atlanta, completely new environment. Everything was new. And, I think that's good. I think that's a really good thing to do for life. It teaches you things. It's a good experience, and we only get one crack at this. So I felt like if that opportunity was there, why not take it? Why I could have stayed in MMA and kept doing it, but, why not take on this new challenge and, kind of like add to your life experiences, which I think are so crucial.
I'd be remiss to ask, like, covering the UFC, like, I think, like, you're covering the NFL, where I think most would look at it as very much like a church and state separation. Covering the UFC when the ESPN is a broadcast partner, was that ever something that was ever that you found yourself difficult because you're covering television deals, you're covering like business stories related to the UFC, or did they allow like that separation, that those lines were never blurred?
I mean, it was mostly fine. There were some times here and there where, you know, there's some butting of the heads behind the scenes because ESPN is in business with the UFC, and that's just how things are in this day and age, right? That there's, it's hard to avoid. It's like that in all sports, right? You know, people that work for the broadcast partner in all sports have to deal with that type of potential conflict. But for the most part, you know, my editors at ESPN supported everything that I wanted to do. And, you know, they were pretty much down for pretty much. And, you know, I never got told by an editor at ESPN, like, oh, we can't do this because it'll piss off, you know, UFC or Dana White. I was never told that at ESPN. So, you know, I consider that a good thing. You know, were there, you know, would I have loved to like maybe cover more of like the other promotions outside of the UFC at times? Certainly, you know, when Bellator was hot, and I did, I mean, I pushed for it and I did cover Bellator a decent amount, and PFL, of course, well, they're on ESPN too, you know, as well.
You were so. Also covering like the antitrust lawsuit, and it's like,
yeah, of course.
Like, you know, you were covering like a lot of, like, as I said, like really important stuff that I think needs to be out there in the media cycle. I'll end it off on this, because one of the questions I always hate at the press conferences is when a fighter has just completed this big task and then it's like, what's next? So I couch it with that, but you have completed this. Like, did this leave you with the desire that it's daunting, but I would go through this process again, wanting to write another book, whether it be wrestling or other, or is that too far ahead for you to look at as a potential goal for a follow-up down the road?
So I would love to write another book. I think I want to see how all this goes, because again, like talking about knowing your audience and, you know, what does your audience want? I want to see how this one is received. And I think that, you know, my biggest things that was in the back of my head the entire time that I wrote this book was I'm very aware that this era of wrestling has been covered an awful lot, right? By documentaries and by, you know, a lot of written work and by podcasts. And, you know, I am a hardcore wrestling fan, right? We were in Tokyo together at the Tokyo.
That's right. Time, yes.
Right. You know, and
we went to Ribera together.
We went to Ribera Steakhouse together. That's right. We didn't get jackets though. What's up with that?
Yeah. I don't know. Next time. That's next a sophomore time. Appearance.
So the whole time, man, I was thinking like, is there enough in here that like, as a hardcore wrestling fan, you know, to kind of serve those folks, right? And I tried the best I could to, you know, give people different, you know, bits of detail and different like angles on things and, you know, new stuff. I found the NWO logo designer who no one knew who she was for Great almost story. 30 years, you know, and, you know, stuff like that. Interviews with people that don't really do interviews very much, like an Ellis Edwards, you know, Jerry McDevitt that doesn't do a ton of interviews. You know, just guys like that. I obtained over 4,000 pages from the lawsuit. You know, I was really like, that was like the big thing for me is like, I need to give the hardcore fans, you know, I need to throw them some red meat, right? And that was really important for me to do. And I hope that I succeeded in doing that, but also trying to serve like the casual fans and the lapsed fans, right? I saw like three very distinct like demographics, the hardcore fans, the lapsed fans and the non-fans. And lapsed fans, there are so many of them, man. Like there are so many people who are watching in the 90s who have not watched in 20 years or 25 years. And I really wanted this to be a book that they could pick up very easily and it would transport them right back to the 90s, like during their childhood. And it can be sometimes hard to serve like multiple masters when it comes to that, as far as like the target audience. Because sometimes you get too in the weeds, you know, to serve the hardcore fan, right? You get too in the weeds, you're too inside baseball, so to speak, and it turns off. It's no longer accessible to folks who just want to pick up a book for the summer and read it on the beach, you know? Someone, you know, people are going to be, you know, in Target or Walmart or Barnes & Noble, and they're going to see this book and be like, oh, yeah, let me read that. And if it's too in the weeds, it's like, what the hell, you know, what the hell is this, you know? So yeah, you have to make it accessible. And that was the biggest challenge of writing the book. And to kind of get back to your question, it's like, I'll see how this goes as far as, you know, did I do a good enough job serving all those audiences? I feel like I did. I tried my damnedest, you know, You know, we'll see what the folks say, because they're the, you know, the fans are the ones that, you know, the decide this type of stuff. I've gotten mostly, you know, almost entirely, honestly, good feedback so far about the book from, you know, all three of those kind of, you know, target demographics. So we'll see. You know, I would love to do another one. I love wrestling. I love writing about wrestling. I love writing about wrestling kind of in the context of culture, because I think it doesn't get talked enough about in that way. It doesn't get the credit that it deserves as far as the influence goes. So certainly I would love to do another one, but you know, the fans are going to kind of put their thumb up or thumb down probably on that one as far as the future.
Well, if you're looking for a book proposal for something, an easy beach read, the Jerry McDivitt Chronicles could rank very high. I would argue, Mark, I would steer you in that direction. But I want to send everyone in the direction over here to say hello to the bad guys, how professional wrestling's new world order changed America. All right. You have any issue with America at the moment? Blame the NWO. Mark Ramondi's book is out now. Do check it out. And of course, bestowed with the great honor that one of our new series, Book Club, is going to be covering this book next month on the Post Wrestling Cafe. Myself and Neil Flanagan will be reviewing Say Hello to the Bad Guys. So awesome. That is coming up next month. Mark, thanks so much for taking this amount of time out. You have had a very busy promotional campaign for the book. I know you have to get back to this. You're like running for office here, selling this book.
Can you see how tired I am? Like, can you see it in my eyes? Like how...
You're as tired as Wei Ting right now on 2 hours of sleep, but you have a 2 a.m. flight that is your excuse. So we thank you very much for sitting down with us, Mark, and all the best with the continued promotion of the book, and congratulations. Like, it's no small task what you did here, and I thought you brought out some like really interesting like reporting to this, new names that have not been heard from before, and you know, covering a subject that there's a lot out on, and it's very difficult to tackle that with new information, and I think you've certainly achieved that.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate that a lot.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.